This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, we are going to move on to our topic of the week in just a few minutes, but before we do, we have a very special guest on the phone. Paul Johnson is working with Terry Goddard on the Outlaw Dirty Money campaign. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thanks for having us. We really appreciate it.
Well, tell us what you're doing, why anybody ought to care.
Well, we're out there passing petitions trying to outlaw dirty money, kind of the dark money that have begun to infiltrate our campaigns. It's not the first time that we've attempted to do it. Last time we tried to get this on the ballot, some of the dark money got involved and they were able to stop us. This is a citizens type of effort. We're out there trying to push these petitions. What they would do is they would just basically ensure that you have to disclose who it is that's contributing money into our campaigns back to the source. It's funny, 2 years ago we made the comment that what was happening with dark money was going to be problematic. And we even made the prediction that at some point in time in the future, we'd start to see this dark money have an effect with foreign countries as well as illegitimate sources getting involved in our campaign. I find it fascinating that everybody's kind of mad at Facebook today because of what they've been doing in terms of allowing some of those sources to get involved in Facebook. But I think we have to pay attention to the fact that it's really hard for Facebook to determine who these sources are as well when you don't force them to disclose who it is that's contributing money into a Facebook ad or into any other campaign. We believe this is something that has to be done by the citizens. It's clearly not going to be done by the legislature. It is not going to be done by the courts. It's going to have to be done by a citizens initiative effort. We've got petitions out there. We're asking people to get involved, to help us pass petition, and to help us make this effort successful.
How many signatures do you need?
Well, we're hoping to get 300,000. We have about half of those in right now. We have commitments for some big chunks on the outside. But if we can just collect literally half of the petitions that citizens have taken, we'll get to the 300,000 number.
But now, that includes a pad, doesn't it? That's a little bit more than you actually need,
correct?
Because this is under the strict compliance rule, which is if somebody doesn't dot an I or cross a T, they toss it.
Yeah, the legislature passed a rule that says that literally if somebody forgets to cross a T in their name, the signature would be thrown out. So having a big buffer is important.
Which I would note is a requirement they did not apply to their own petitions.
Yeah, they definitely want one set of rules for them and a different set of rules for everybody else.
And you have to go out in 110 degree heat and pass these things physically, whereas the legislative petitions, the petitions they pass themselves, they get to do it online.
Yeah, and you know what's really fascinating about this goes all the way back to statehood for Arizona. The initiative process is something that the founders wanted in our state constitution because they understood that there are these special interest groups who want to block out the citizens from being able to have a voice. When you add that to the partisan system and gerrymandering and a whole set of other things, it's becoming increasingly more difficult for the public to have a say. What we believe is the starting point of changing that is to outlaw the dirty money that is in the system. What's also interesting is that with the dark money advent, we've actually created an incentive for people that when they give money into the political system, to do it anonymously. That is just simply not compatible with what we know as a free and open republic, and our goal is to try to change it.
Now, in the sake of full disclosure, this really doesn't eliminate contributions, right? It just requires that the original source be disclosed.
No, yeah, we believe that if people have the right to know who's giving the money, then all of a sudden there's a disadvantage to giving larger sums of money because people begin to believe that, in fact, people are trying to buy the system. So it does have an effect. It doesn't stop people from giving any amount that they want, but it just simply makes them have to stand up and defend why are they giving those large sums of money to the elected official of their choice.
And then I think, especially in some cases where the conflict of interest is obvious.
No, it, you know, as I said, we're actually creating an incentive for groups to not disclose the money that they're giving. And what's even more dangerous about this is the thing that worries me the most. There's no doubt. I was mayor of Phoenix. We saw all types of interest trying to influence the body politic. And sometimes those interests were definitely in conflict with the common interest. Sometimes they were very close or over the border of being illegitimate. It was much more difficult for them to do that in an environment where they had to disclose who it is that they were giving money. Today, the ability to give money, I really do believe a big portion, without blaming the president or anyone else, that a big portion of what's going on with this Russian investigation is that they figured out a way to give money anonymously. They figured out a way to filter money into the American system and to give money without anybody having the right to know that they gave it. Well, if this group can do it, so can a wide variety of other interest groups. It's just better for the public if we all have a right to know who's actually giving money. And in the end, I actually think it's better for the elected officials as well, because it will keep some of these nefarious groups from getting involved.
Well, the city of Tempe had an opportunity to speak out in this issue in the last election.
And it was overwhelming.
91%. I've never seen anything get 91%. Mother's Day couldn't get 91%.
Our polling says that Republicans, Democrats, and Independents all want this type of measure in the 90% numbers. And, you know, and again, I'm not one of those who blames, you know, individuals, politicians who are in the system today for why it exists. They're doing what we've allowed them to do by the rules. The only way to change that is by a vote of the people to tell them this is not something we want. It's not something that's acceptable. And we want to make certain that if you're getting money from someone, that we have a right to know who it is.
Okay, we got just a few seconds here. What's your deadline, and how does somebody contact you if they want to get involved?
We have a little more than 3 weeks. Go to Google Outlaw Dirty Money. You'll find us right there. You'll be able to hook on. We'd love for you to get a petition. Go get 20 signatures for it. And if you have petitions, if you've already taken them out, get them back to us as quick as you possibly can.
Okay, thank you very much. That was Paul Johnson, who, along with Terry Goddard, is spearheading this Outlaw Dirty Money campaign. If you stick around in the think tank, we have it all. Sex, money, politics, intrigue, and some good journalism. And a fascinating story of truly Shakespearean dimensions. How's that for a tease? We'll be back with you in just a moment in the think tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back. Our guests, which we have not mentioned until this moment, are Francine Hardaway and Jenna Bummersbach. The story we're going to talk about, and Jenna's written a book about this, where we're going to get to, but we want to set this up. We go back to 1970 with the formation of the New Times. Francine, you were an original investor in participation in basically the setup of the New Times.
Well, I was the first film reviewer for the New Times, and I invested my talent, so to speak, because they didn't pay anybody to write. So I wrote for nothing, but I also fed Mike Lacy because I had a credit card and he didn't have any money. And they were just starting up the New Times.
What was the concept?
I became a real investor.
Okay. What was the concept?
What was the concept?
Yeah. What is the New Times going to be?
The
1970.
The
71.
New Times is going to be an alternative weekly to publish all the stuff that the Arizona Republic didn't publish, and to do investigative, high quality investigative reporting.
And I came here, I know, Jenna, you started working there 75, 76.
Uh-huh.
I know that I came here in 79, and it was clear that the New Times was just that. And you were
a big
part of that.
It was a fabulous, kick-ass newspaper. I mean, it was the best newspaper in Arizona during that time. From the mid-70s, I think, until the 90s, maybe a little, even later than that, into almost the 2000. It was the paper that went after every sacred cow that that the Republic had. It went after corrupt politicians. It took Joe Arpaio to task. It was the only people brave enough to take Arpaio on. It was the kind of journalism that every journalist in the country would have been proud to be associated with.
And I think the manifestation of that. Now, this is in this context. I remember because back then in the late 70s, early 80s, the Arizona Republic pretended that this was this insignificant little rag.
Right, right.
And then the professional journalist every year would vote for the journalist of the year. And right. I know you won it a few times.
Well,
Terry Green yeah. Sterling won.
It was always someone from the New Times.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And you're winning the statement
biggest
of that. So there was a disconnect between the management of the Republic and what their own journalists were saying.
And in the contest, which was judged by out-of-state journalists, New Times always won more awards than anybody else in the entire state. You know, I remember one year that Mike Lacy himself won more single awards than any journalist had ever won. So, I mean, we had a paper that was recognized around the nation as being a wonderful voice of journalism.
Francine, were you around? I just love the artichoke story.
Well, yes, I was around because I was on the opening faculty of Scottsdale Community College, and we were the college that voted the artichoke as a mascot, and that was – it still is.
I checked it out last night. It's still there.
It still is the mascot, and that was done because and actually the New Times was, so to speak, on our side in that one because we didn't want sports teams, and we thought the idea of sports and mascots and all that BS was overblown. And so the student body actually, because at that time I was advising the Scottsdale newspaper, the student newspaper, the student body voted on the artichoke as a mascot, and it was in defiance.
This was a finger in the eye.
Totally. A total finger in the eye of the administration of the community college district. Wow, those were the good old days.
So, Dana, what was it like to work there?
It could be fabulous and it could be horrible. Lacey was a very hard taskmaster, and sometimes he could be wonderful, and other times he could be an absolute bastard. So you had to kind of figure out that each day how things were going to go. But I loved my time there. I loved the kinds of stories I got to write. I loved the kinds of people we got to work with. I loved embarrassing the Arizona Republic almost every week. It was a pretty incredible time.
You know, I will tell you one little secret as somebody who's done market research for a lot of places. I had occasion to go into the market research office of the Arizona Republic during this period when they were saying that, you know, that's insignificant. Wasn't the office was plastered with data on the New Times.
I bet.
The public posture was a little different from what was going on inside the building.
And they constantly shot themselves in their foot. I mean, at one point, remember, we were doing this thing on Horizon on Channel 8. It was a roundtable discussion of journalists, and I had been one of the original people on that show. Well, Duke Tully decided that his people couldn't appear.
Duke Tully!
Remember?
Duke Tully could not appear.
There's only a handful of us who remember the Duke Tully.
He was the publisher of the Republic, and he was a total phony. But he declared that none of his legitimate journalists could appear with any illegitimate journalists like Janet Boomerspach at New Times. And so and tried to tell Channel 8 who they could have on the air. And instead, Channel 8 said, Janet's invited every single week. So for a year, I was on that stupid show it's a good show, but every single week I had to go out and do that show to keep the Republic people off, and it just blew up in their face.
And later, Duke Tully was, you know, ridden out of town on a rail because he lied about his war experience.
Right.
He never was in the service. And he used to talk to me, he used to take me to lunch at Avanti and talk to me about his war wounds.
Yeah.
And I was like such a good little girl. I believed him.
Well, I think everybody did.
And he wore medals that he had bought at the...
He wore medals. That's exactly right.
Bought at the commissary.
And he had photos up in his bathroom in his house of himself flying these planes. And it was all fake news.
All fake.
So I remember the other thing. I think it must have been before they yanked you. Horizon did a point counterpoint with you and John Colby.
And John Colby
was the greatest segment. Of the week.
We had great stuff. We did great stuff. And then I got my own show for a while, and that was wonderful. And I would get on every week and do a commentary on Channel 8, which won all kinds of national awards. And so that was wonderful to sort of spread the word beyond the realm of New Times. So I took my liberal thoughts and I put them on Channel 8.
Now, let's fast forward just a little bit. 2007, the raid.
What 2007?
Oh, Arpaio.
Arpaio's office.
Okay, so the New Times, and I remember this because, of course, I'm still very friendly with Mike Lacy. The New Times actually arrested Mike and Jim. Arpaio arrested Mike and Jim, went to their houses, and put them in jail because Mike and Jim had been covering how Arpaio was treating immigrants and the racial profiling that he was doing. And the riot is...
I think that there was also about his real estate dealings was part of the...
Oh, yes, that too. And the costs in the sheriff's office and the posse and the pink underwear. You know, he was a disgrace, Arpaio. And Mike and Jim suffered for that.
We will pick up that part of the story, and we will ultimately get to Jana's book, the name of which is?
The Dead Girl in the Vacant Lot.
Okay, we'll get there, all in the think tank, as we discover as we walk through the whole long saga of the New Times, Mike Lacy, back page and the whole thing, when we return in just a moment in the think tank.
Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back with Jana Bommersbach, with Francine Hardaway. We're talking about the long saga, the history of the New Times, Mike Lacy, ultimately back page, and leading us into Jana's recent book, The Dead Girl in the Vacant Lot. Mm-hmm. I'm partway through reading that. Okay. Good. It's 2007. There's a late night raid on Mike Lacy, the publisher of the New Times,
and Jim Larkin.
And Jim Larkin, the
he's the publisher.
He's the publisher. Mike's the executive editor.
Yeah. And they ask for they arrest them, and then they put out a demand to provide. I think the web, all the people who
this
visit
is beforehand. Wait, yeah. This is before you're getting ahead of yourself. They arrested them because they dared print a story telling the world that the Arpaio was trying to get the grand jury to go after New Times, every reader, every advisor, every advertiser, every person of the website, that they were trying to exploit their lawsuit in order to ruin New Times. It was a direct attack on the First Amendment, and Lacy and Larkin would not stand for it. And for the first time in the history of the New Times, the two men together jointly wrote an article that exposed what the grand jury was doing. Now, it's a misdemeanor to tell what the grand jury is doing, okay? But as Mike said in that intro, sometimes civil disobedience is the only answer you've got left.
And since somebody's misusing the
grand
jury process.
And since Arpaio seemed to have sway then, he seemed to have everybody in his corner, including the Arizona Republic and those other people, this was their one defense. And so they, I think, very righteously printed that article and then were arrested that night, claiming that they were some kind of danger to society, which is exactly how my book begins, because that incident, I still find the most outrageous attack on the First Amendment that we've ever seen in this country. And I'm still appalled that more people did not respond to how unbelievably horrible this was that Arpaio did this.
And even Andrew Thomas, who was an ally of the sheriff, I think he dropped it within a day.
And in fact, he lost his whole career because of this case, because he had sanctioned all of this stuff privately behind the scenes and then dared to say, well, I had nothing to do with any of this stuff. This was all got out of my control. So it was a huge black mark on the entire media of Arizona, on the entire state of Arizona.
But then Lacy and Larkin turned around and sued and won. And took the proceeds from the lawsuit,
which was $3.75 million,
and established a foundation for basically journalism that had to do with immigration topics. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's called the Frontera Foundation.
And they also gave $2 million to ASU to create a chair. ASU has since returned the $2 million. Because of the controversy that would eventually swirl around Mike Lacy and Jim Larkin.
Because of Backpage?
And Backpage.com.
Even though this predated that.
Which became an online brothel.
Mm. Well, okay.
Well, I know, and this is where I think your positions diverge a little bit. But
well, let me tell you, because that's
well,
what
our positions don't really diverge because I know there were ads on Backpage,
which originally was the back page of the physical
right.
paper.
I know there were ads on Backpage for sex. The real question was, what was the role of Lacey and Larkin in what happened when Backpage started?
And I understand the legal issue is, are you a participant in that, or are you merely a publisher? Not unlike the position, for example, of a cable operator, if you're providing an internet feed.
Yeah, exactly. The position is there is a law which is called, actually, this Communications Decency Act.
The worst named law in the world.
I know. Known as Section 230, that basically protected the platform provider from what was put on the platform.
Right. But here was the rule. The rule was, if you were simply conduiting it through, if you were simply – somebody bought an ad and you placed it on just like Yelp or Google or any newspaper, right? And you had nothing to do with printing that ad, with writing that ad, with creating the content of that ad. Mm-hmm. You were simply the purveyor of that ad. You were protected under this law.
Right.
And for 50 lawsuits, Mike and Jim prevailed in that they were protected until – Congress finally went to the courts and got them to force them to turn over a million documents where they proved that indeed they were writing the ads. They were sanitizing the ads. They were making them look like they were legitimate ads when they were indeed prostitution ads for children.
They had other reasons for doing that, and one of them was so that they weren't really providing those ads. In other words, they did not really want those ads on there. And so they were trying to not change the ads, but they were trying to make sure that the ads didn't promote something that they didn't really want to promote. Because at the same time as they were doing that, Lacey and Larkin were funding a shelter for wayward girls in L.A. And what they wanted was for the girls to go there.
Let me quote from the Senate committee. Backpage, quote, has knowingly concealed evidence of criminality by systematically editing its adult ads. By October 2010, Backpage created an ad filter that edited out words like Lolita, teenage, rape young, Amber Alert, little girl, teen, fresh, innocent, and schoolgirl. Internal documents showed that by the late 2010, Backpage was editing 70 to 80% of its ads in the adult section. And when the suspicious word or an age under 18 came about, the buyer would get an error message that would allow the post to be sanitized. So it could go on the air. And as its own staff told the Congress that they knew they were doing sex trafficking for children, but they were told that their job was to, quote, put lipstick on a pig.
There were, well, according to Lacey, there were only about 3 underage ads found when the FBI and Robert Mueller went around the country.
Mueller was at the time director of the FBI.
Mueller was
the... Because I don't want to confuse that with...
Yeah, Mueller was the director of the FBI, and Mueller was investigating this, and he only found 3 underage people in all the ads that...
Oh, Francine, if that's what Mike is telling you, he is feeding you bull caca. That is absolutely not what's happened. And that's exactly what the Congress found. The major...
Well, let's talk about the politics of it, Jana, because...
The politics of it is, are you going to sell children for sex?
No.
That's the politics of it.
No, the politics of it is that Kamala Harris wanted to build a career.
Oh,
and Cindy McCain, too. This is where we disagree. Because there were a number of people who realized that they couldn't really get support for limiting sex work because sex work among adults has rights, but they knew that they could raise money and get political support for child trafficking. And so they couched the whole issue as child trafficking.
Well, I totally disagree with that. Let me quote Senator Claire McCaskill, who was the co-chair of this of the Senate committee. She's a former sex crime prosecutor from Missouri.
Yeah, of
she
course.
She said, quote, "They did not turn away ads selling children. They just tried to make it less obvious. And worse, coached the traffickers and the pimps on how to clean up their ads. These children were still sold. They just tried to sanitize it. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the definition of evil. Simply evil."
But that is a sex crime prosecutor.
When are you
view.
Against sex crime prosecutors? How can you be against sex crime prosecutors?
I am not. My foster daughter lived with, I don't want to say this on the air, but I do want to say this. The whole idea of underage sex crime is far more complicated than either your book or the government's case against Lacey lets on, because a lot of this cannot be stopped given larger social circumstances. You can't, if you stop something like Backpage, then you force all this sex traffic out into the street where there are no records, and it's much more dangerous. It's not like when you shut down Backpage, it goes away. There was no Backpage when my foster daughter had her issues. And she actually volunteered for those issues, so to speak, because she had no other way out at the time. So this is a complex social issue that has to do with drugs and parenting and a whole lot of stuff beyond sex crimes in the new times.
Well, I will we'll pick this up in just a couple of minutes. As you saw, at this point, all I had to do was get out of the way and let you go. I two of the most articulate people we've ever had on this show, and so it made my job easy. We will be back in just a minute. We will let Jenna talk a little bit specifically about her book, and we will wrap this discussion in the Think Tank in just a minute.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back with Jenna Broomersbach and with Francine Hardaway talking about the New Times, Backpage, sex trafficking, and related issues. And Jenna wrote a book, and we talked about this before we went on the air. I'm not quite sure whether I find this in the fiction or the nonfiction set, because it's obviously not a complete work of fiction, but there are elements that are fictionalized. Where do find this book?
You find this book. Is this the hybrid book? This is how I write my fiction books. My journalist in me demands I tell a true story. My fiction writer part of me wants to weave a great story around those true events. And so this is what I chose for The Dead Girl in the Vacant Lot. Let me just give you a tiny primer on sex trafficking in this country. There are 100,000 children, mainly girls, but also some boys, every year in the United States of America who are being forced into sex slavery. That is either being enticed by paramours who they think are their lovers, and oh my God, this is their new boyfriend, or they're kidnapped.
That was your character. Yeah. That was the story that you told in the book.
Right. So one of them is called a Romeo pimp because he seduces you. The other is called a gorilla pimp because he kidnaps you. All these things are going on, but 100,000 people, according to the National Center for Abused and Neglected Children, are being trafficked every year. It is an issue that is affecting everything from small towns in North Dakota to big cities like Phoenix. Phoenix happens to be a hub because of our giant sporting events, which draw in these kids from all over the world. Their pimps bring them in here because the demand is so high during those big sporting events that they can make tons of money, and because Phoenix is the birthplace of Backpage.com, which became the number one purveyor of information and the number one place where children in America were being sold.
But again, this is still an issue that's far more complex than just the Super Bowl draws in the pimps. The girls themselves have some, they're complicit. And
you want to blame the victims for this?
Blaming the victims. I'm blaming the victims' parents and the households they come from.
Well, they may have a role in this too.
This is a large social problem.
But when a girl is being raped again and again and again and again because a pimp has enticed her into this world and captured her and enslaved her in this world, I am not going to spend a lot of time crying about their parents. I'm going to try to save that girl. And that is what I think the main emphasis of all the people who are doing sex trafficking work is.
Let me just
get these girls safe.
Introduce a little part of the factual story here is that in April of this year, 2018, the Justice Department announced the seizure of Backpage, which has been separated from the New Times.
Right.
Mike Lacy and all sold the New Times, which had become actually a conglomerate.
13 papers.
And what they wanted to do when they sold the New Times was continue fighting the First Amendment battle to be able to be a platform provider. And that was what they wanted to separate out, the wonderful journalism that the New Times was known for, from that battle, which they considered a First Amendment rights battle.
And just again, factual point, they are currently facing seven individuals, of whom Mike Lacy is one and Larkin is another, faced a 93-count federal indictment.
Right.
Which is currently in litigation.
Right. And the trial is supposed to start in January of 2020. Mm-hmm. Currently, Lacy and Larkin have ankle bracelets and are under house arrest, or they can't leave Arizona. Mm-hmm. And their passports have been seized and all of that. And the guy who was the chief executive officer for them, Carl Ferver, has turned on them. He has decided to become state's evidence. Mm-hmm. His plea deal is a 5-year prison term. A plea deal for 5 years. Imagine what they're going to try to do to these guys. They're going to be facing many, many, many decades in prison. I'm sure that's what the prosecutors are going to ask for.
Francine, you don't think this is the way to deal with this issue?
I don't. It's first of all not the way to deal with child trafficking. Second,
then what is?
Second, it's a social issue. In my particular case, the case that I knew about, the mother had become a crack whore at age 16, had 4 children after that, and the children all became something, even after they were put in the foster care system. And they also had no way to live if they didn't sell their bodies because nobody fed them. You know what I'm saying? There was no home life, no home to go back to. They were my foster children, but the mother would never sever custody, so we could never adopt.
The mother still had some legal rights.
The mother had legal rights. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And the mother wanted the children because each child was, $400 worth of child support or whatever it is the state aid to defend dependent children. So these children run away from these abusive households. And when they run away, they have nowhere to go. And the first pimp that finds them, that's true.
So
Jenna,
how they get into this thing, there are a variety of ways. How do they get out of this thing? That's what I'm trying to get at. How do you get these children out of that horrible sex slavery situation?
A properly functioning foster care system could do it.
Well, no, it could not. You have to shut down the vehicle that lets them be sold. Listen to this from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. From 2010, when Backpage became the number one internet site for selling children until 2015, reports of suspected child sex trafficking increased 846%, and 73% of those reports came from the public involved Backpage.
But here's the problem. They did shut down Backpage. And the day after I spend a lot of time on social media. The day they shut down Backpage.
If you go to Backpage right now, which I did last night in preparation, there's a FBI warning.
Yeah, exactly.
Put in an April
so
thing.
They totally shut down Backpage. And the sex workers went crazy because they're mad at the government because what this did was drive the traffic back out into the streets.
Well, better on the street, where you can only sell one child at a time, then onto a site that's in 97 countries and over thousands of internet abilities.
But before they shut down Backpage and before the government made it impossible for them to take credit cards, they used to take credit cards for their ads. And then they would give the credit card numbers of the people who placed the ads to law enforcement. So they were actually helping law enforcement. And that's why Mueller got gave some, you know, certificate to them for what they were doing.
When was that?
I'm going to say 2015.
Mm-hmm. Several years ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But
I find that really hard to believe.
Well,
I find that really hard to believe. I mean, by 2015, the whole world knew what Backpage was doing. By 2015, the attorney generals of all 50 states were involved.
But you see, you can work in cooperation with law enforcement and turn things over to law enforcement.
But the few cases they turned over were minuscule compared to the number of cases they had on their site. They were sanitizing these ads constantly to take out all the words that told you this was a child. But the whistles, the dog whistles were still there, you know? So, I mean, everybody...
They were reporting the people who put those ads on.
One or two people out of thousands?
Not one or two people out of thousands. Way more than that. And
they certainly were doing a bad job of it then, because they were not keeping this thing from going hog wild.
Well, let me say, and I know you know this too, Jana, that in all the years that we both have known Mike Lacy... you know that he's not a child trafficker. You know that. And you know that his motivation is not money. His motivation is First Amendment freedoms and free journalism. And now he has come to believe that adult sex workers also have rights. And the sex workers think they have rights.
Well, adult sex workers should have rights. I totally agree with Sweden, which has legalized prostitution because it puts women in charge of what's going on.
But see, what has happened is this.
We're talking about children. We're only talking about
children. The whole issue has gotten conflated.
Well, not in the minds of the people who are prosecuting them.
Of course not, because a lot of those people are politically motivated.
Well, if this is political motivation, then I'm all for political motivation. Because if you're politically motivated to stop an internet site from selling children for sex, then I want that site shut down.
I want to ask you, Jana, a question. Yeah. You were with Mike Lacy in the early days. What's your assessment of how this came about?
I don't know what happened.
Did this fall into this, or was this design?
I don't know what happened to him. I mean, you love this guy. I do not know how he could have gone so far to the dark side.
He didn't. That's the whole point.
Yes, he did.
He did.
And it breaks my heart. It does break my heart.
Okay, no conclusion, but as promised, a fascinating discussion. Jana Boomersbach, the girl in the vacant lot, Francine Hardaway, always welcome here.
The dead girl in the vacant
lot. Dead girl in the vacant lot. Okay. Just Google Jana.
Okay. Thank you.
See you next week in The Thinking.